you could only be tuned to WRUV FM Burlington 90.1 on your radio dial.
WRUV FM Burlington.
The radio voice of the University of Vermont, your better alternative.
You are listening to 90.1 WRUV FM Burlington. Thanks, as always, for listening.
I saw her sitting in the rain.
Have you ever questioned why gifting flowers is such a common gesture of kindness or love? Well, listen here. Believe it or not, the presence of flowers triggers happy emotions. Their presence also increases the feeling of life satisfaction and positively affects social behavior. A team of researchers from Rutgers conducted a 10-month study that has concluded that flowers are a natural and healthy way to regulate your mood. Dr. Jeanette Haviland-Jones found that flowers have an immediate impact on happiness. All study participants expressed true or excited smiles upon receiving flowers, demonstrating extraordinary delight and gratitude. Flowers have a long-term positive effect on moods. Specifically, study participants reported feeling less depressed, anxious, and agitated after receiving flowers. Flowers make intimate connections. The presence of flowers led to increased contact with family and friends. So, next time you are wondering what to get a loved one or what to bring to a dinner party, bring flowers. They are sure to make the recipient smile. This message is brought to you by your flower-loving DJs here at 90.1 WRUV FM Burlington.
The silver necklace I wear around my neck doesn't represent my love of sailboats. I wouldn't call myself a sailor. I'm not even close to being one, so it might seem strange that I wear a simple sailboat around my neck. I wear it because it represents the week of my life when I was the most uncomfortable, out of place, unsure, inspired, fulfilled, exhausted, but well-fed I have ever been in my life. It represents the week of my life when I lived and worked aboard the sloop Clearwater. Now, when I first heard about the sloop Clearwater, I was getting ready to choose my senior internship for the end of the year project. I was in English class when my awesome English teacher, shout out Miss Artolino, was listing off possible internships. She mentioned one that nobody did last year, but people have loved in the past, and it involved living on a sailboat for 2 weeks and doing environmental education. She said one student who did it in the past had such a great experience, she spent the rest of the summer on the boat and changed her entire college major because of it. I was skeptical. How could living on a boat with no running water be that transformative? But the more I thought about it, the more I was intrigued. The deadline to pick my internship was fast approaching, and no other options were really appearing, so I started taking it seriously. I had no idea what I was getting into the morning I was dropped off at a New York City dock with my polka dot suitcase and my unicorn pillow pet. It turns out I would be deeply impacted by the people I met and the things that I did. So much so that I'm doing a podcast about it months and months later. Without further ado, welcome to Bridge the Gap. Today's episode is about the man, the myth, the legend, Pete Seeger, and his quiet and humble ability to change people's hearts and minds, one song at a time. Hello, and welcome to Bridge the Gap. I am your host, Evie Butts. Today on the show, I want to tell you the story of folk artist Pete Seeger and how he used the power of local action to work towards global and lasting change. Today on the show, we will hear from Professor Lexi Perlow about the history of the hidden hero, Pete Seeger, and how he used music for good and demonstrated the idea of thinking globally, acting locally. This concept is really important in the environmental field because oftentimes it's overwhelming to think about any problem on a large scale, but it's easier to break down and even solve problems in our communities and homes. You'll hear about the many ways Pete worked behind the scenes around many well-known causes and influential figures. Next, you will hear about my personal favorite work of Pete's, the Sloop Clearwater, and how and why it came to be. Last, you will hear the kind of work the Sloop is doing today from Charlotte Song, a UVM student who got to experience sailing up and down the Hudson River aboard the Clearwater this past summer. And with that, let's get started.
One of his professors told him, "You can't change the world, Pete," and that really bothered him. If you know anything about Pete Seeger, that's all he wanted to do, was change the world through music.
This is Professor Lexi Perlow, who teaches first-year writing, pop culture, and musicology at UVM. She has done research specifically about musical icon Bob Dylan, but is familiar with Pete as he was a mentor figure in Bob's life at the beginning of his career. In true professor and music history-loving fashion, she came very prepared with many facts and dates about Pete. Here's Professor Perlow on Pete's early influences.
Yeah, so Pete Seeger was born May 3rd, 1919 in New York City, and he actually came from a family of musicians. So his father was a musicologist and a professor, and his mother was a classical violinist. His family was super musical, and he always knew he was going to sort of take a path in music. And then at age 17, he went to Harvard, and then he dropped out after 1 year. So he dropped out, actually, and this is sort of, you can consider this like an anti-villain origin story, because this kind of was his hero origin story. One of his professors told him, "You can't change the world, Pete," and that really bothered him. If you know anything about Pete Seeger, that's all he wanted to do, was change the world through music. So he dropped out of Harvard because he found his professors to be too pessimistic. The first band that he starts is called the Almanac Singers. And one thing that was sort of unique about this band is that they wore street clothes, right? So instead of dressing up for concerts, they looked like they were going to go work in the mines, or they were going to go work on the farm, right? And another really important thing that would become this huge part of Seeger's whole shtick when it came to performing is that they encouraged audiences to sing along with them in a communal style. So this is something that like might have been done locally in festivals and things like that. But if you were going to go see a band, this was not something they usually asked audiences to do. So this was sort of new. So Seeger was really involved with the civil rights movement. So he would go to all of the protests that he could. But of course, he organizes at the Newport Folk Festival a group of people to sing We Shall Overcome. So we have Dylan in there, we have Joan Baez in there, we have Peter, Paul, and Mary in there. So some of these really big names in the industry, and he's using the Newport Folk Festival as sort of an outlet to hear these famous people sing and advocate for civil rights. So he had a hand in that. But again, right, he was behind the scenes, yeah. He also was highly against the draft and advocated for ending the Vietnam War. So he has this song that sort of, it was translated from French originally, called Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Yeah, it's a very beautiful song. It makes me tear up every time. And it's a song that sort of talks about the reminder of how futile and cyclical and sad war is. Because oftentimes we see like the glory and we hear history from the victors and all of those things. But we don't think about necessarily the individual soldiers who are losing their life and all of these young, vibrant people who are just like washed from this world because of fighting. So he really popularized that song, and of course that made him sort of a target for court cases and anti-communist sentiments. And then of course he did the coal miner strikes and the workers' rights. He went to plenty of these rallies. He had tons and tons of songs written for these people. And some of his most famous were Solidarity and Which Side Are You On, which is super fun to hear. And he got all of these like big, burly, working class dudes to sing these songs with him, which I think is like one of the greatest powers of Seeger, is that like he's so dorky, right? Like it's undeniable how dorky he was, but his enthusiasm for workers' rights and his like pure advocacy for people just made other people want to join in with the dorkiness. So there's some really like beautiful videos out there of these like coal miners covered in dirt and soot and all of that. singing Which Side Are You On? And it's just like one of those solidifying moments where Pete is an activist and an advocate. In fact, he's like one of the perfect examples of an activist here. But he was no Malcolm X, right? He wasn't like trying to lay his life out on the line. He's much more ideological. And the idea that you can change people's minds through music seems almost like silly, right? Especially if we think about like the way that in which the civil rights culminated in marches and protests that ended so violently, right? And caused so much bloodshed and tears and strife, right? It's hard to reconcile in your head that something as simple as music could be as effective as laying your life out on the line like we saw in that time. But I think Seeger had this like quiet power, right? He was playing the long game, sort of similar to Martin Luther King in many ways, right? He wasn't thinking about the most violent act that you could commit to get people's attention, right? He didn't think you had to do that. He worked a lot with children in schools. So his idea was that if we can get them young, right, and tell them about how important it is to participate and help, right? Help out, help people who are minoritized or people who are disenfranchised, then we don't have to get to this level that we're at this point with the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement and all of these things. So he has this quotation, and I have, see, now I'm dorky, I'll tell you, I have this this poster in my office at home, which is a animated little picture of Pete Seeger with a banjo, and it says, "Participation, that's what's going to save the human race." And I have to remind myself that all the time, because I like to do things myself. I'm like, well, the only one I can count on is me. But then, like, you have to remind yourself, like, you're not, it, like Pete would say, you're not able to make change just by yourself, right? You have to get people on your side. You have to talk about how important it is to collaborate here. So whether his participation was disruptive was not really something that Pete was focusing on. He was rather making protest and participation a part of like our ethos as a human race, and as a practice, right? Something that you do every day instead of something you do once to cause the most destruction, right? And like, I mean, you can argue like, well, that's not very effective, right? We know that actually some of the most violent movements made the most change, right? But if we think back about all the little things that lead up to something big, Pete was definitely one of those people who put that into focus, that it really is a collective effort and not just a one-time thing.
Professor Perlow also told me about how Pete was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee facing communist allegations. And as he was in court, he kept trying to play songs. At the end of this hearing, he was banned from radio and television for 17 years. This was a factor in the reason why most people don't know Pete Seeger, but here's Professor Perlow with more.
He sort of misses this revolution in music, and the tides were changing, right? We're moving towards musicians who have such a specific individual persona. And then, of course, like, he hates fame, right? Seeger never wanted to be famous. He wanted to change the world. So if you're someone who doesn't really want to be in the spotlight, you're going to get left behind. And then he also focused on uplifting social causes instead of promoting himself. He was never at the forefront, which is why I think he's unnoticed in mainstream history, and people aren't as interested in people who don't have a really strong individual point of view that's easy to like pick out of a crowd, right? He wanted to blend in. He considered himself like part of a human race, not like an individual human.
For Pete, it was not about fame. It was about the music or the causes he was supporting with his music. Pete believed that music was a vessel for hope, and it's there to help you survive your struggles or understand your troubles or just distract you from them. Tying back into that communal aspect, Pete believed that when people made music together, they could be lifted up by it. He understood that when we work together, we can accomplish so much. This is evident in the way he used his musical talent to lift others up by singing about their struggles and having concertgoers sing along with him to get them to feel involved and to get them to care.
It's fine to see the old world and travel up and down among the famous palaces and cities of renown. To admire the crumbling castle and statues of the king. But now I've had enough of antiquated things.
In the same way he got people to care about causes through music, Pete got people to care about the Hudson River by giving them an experience out on the water. Here's Professor Perlow with how he started it.
In 1962, as I'm sure you know because you're a UVM student, Rachel Carson released Silent Spring. And this sort of seminal work, like, people would talk about, writers would talk about the environment in terms of, like, our relationship with it and how it can help us with self-realization and self-actualization. And they would talk about the environment as something to behold in awe, right? Like the sublime and all of that. So it's not really until 1962 that we get to see the ways in which we as human people are harming the environment. So we talked about our relationship in positive ways, but Rachel Carson's really laying out our relationship with the environment and how we are destroying it. This really, Pete cites this as sort of an inspiration for his interest into the environmental activism and the environmental movement. So he wasn't necessarily focused on this before. He was really more focused on like humanistic movements, like the workers' rights movement and the civil rights movement. And then he also read The Sloops of the Hudson. So in the 1800s, we had these like grand cargo ships that sailed the river, right? Which, imagining that now is really crazy because you just wouldn't think of it that way. But this sort of inspired the idea to build an old-fashioned sloop and show how like sad it would look amongst all the pollutants in the river. So it's sort of interesting that he had this idea to build this sloop to show this sort of juxtaposition of like this beautiful, magnificent thing of the past and like what we've done to the Hudson River in the present. Yeah, and lots of people thought this idea was crazy. Yeah. They just thought it was kind of dumb or like not worth raising money for. Like there were other ways that we could prove that we're doing harm to the environment. And like this was going to be very costly, right? This was like sort of a symbolic way to protest, which is not something that everyone thinks is super effective. But it would take 3 years to raise enough money to actually build this thing, right? So in 1968, there's a shipyard in Maine that they commissioned to construct the sloop. And then a couple months later, in May 17th, 1969, the Clearwater, they named the sloop, was launched in Bristol, Maine, and it took 37 days to get to South Street Seaport in New York City. And to see the boat off, again, we have the singing aspect. The crowd sang Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land" as it sort of took off towards New York City. Clearwater became a floating classroom where children took field trips and sang and learned to sail. And in 1972, the Clean Water Act is passed, which forbids anyone to dump pollutants into waterways without express permission. And it also sets up technology-based standards for industrial polluters. So do we ban it completely? No. But we definitely reduce the amount of waste going in to the Hudson River and other waterways across the U.S. So Seeger's legacy helped pass one of the most effective acts for the environmental protection in history. So it's really cool to see that connection, right? With like the sloop also being this experiential learning thing, which seems to be much more transcendental or transformative, I should say, than just consuming.
Like Professor Perlow said, the Clearwater provides a unique learning experience where people can really connect with the river. Building the sloop seems like such a natural pathway of progression for Pete because he was so into getting people involved. So it makes sense